I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Shifting Sands, Saudi Arabia, Inside Out. An American diplomat said, the essential sound of Saudi Arabia is silence. Not perfect silence. In Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, there is also the din of traffic, plying its way around a ribbon of highways that would not be out of place in a new conurbation in the American Sun Belt. A gleaming modern surface, with hardly anybody in the streets. That seems to be the face that Saudi Arabia wants its capital to present to the world. And for a foreigner to find out what lies beneath the surface is no easy task. In other Arab countries, the cities and towns bear the shape of their imperial past, Ottoman and European, and a newcomer can wander through picturesque lanes down to the old town bazaar, or sit in the cool courtyard of the beautiful main mosque and meet people. But in the cities of Saudi Arabia, the architectural past seems to go back only as far as 1973, when oil prices quadrupled and Riyadh, population then about 200,000, population today close to 5 million, began to take shape. Picturesque back alleys were not built into the new city's design, and the mosques are aggressively plain. Now, the absence of pedestrians could be down to a climate that is almost unlivable for 3 months of the year, and even in autumn, is on the cusp of what is bearable for the human animal. But it could also be explained by the fact that the residents of this city have very little to do. So many public social activities taken for granted elsewhere are forbidden by the strict form of Islam that is practiced here. It is forbidden, or haram, to go to the movies. It is haram to listen to music. It is haram for unmarried men and women to meet in public. It is, of course, haram to drink alcohol. Inside Riyadh city limits, it's even haram to go to coffee houses and smoke the traditional Arab shisha, the water pipe, hubbly bubbly. But at the outskirts of Riyadh, where the first world stops and the desert resumes, you can find places to relax with shisha and a non-alcoholic beverage of your choice and try and join in a conversation with ordinary Saudis. The Dana Coffee House is one such place. Out under the stars, it's a little man-made oasis. Around a shallow pool of water and on parched grass underneath palm trees are dozens of television sets perched on little tables. Some of the TVs are tuned into sports, soccer from Europe, football from the U.S., but most of the men here, sitting in little groups of three and four, are watching all the things that are haram. Scantily clad Arab women singing love songs on the Lebanese broadcasting channel, or Egyptian movies from the 1950s with Omar Sharif seducing lovely, young, Western-dressed Arab girls. Not much to do here but talk, a favorite, perhaps the only Saudi pastime. Politics and religion in Saudi Arabia, inseparable topics, dominate many conversations, especially on the extremely rare occasion when an American is around. Three young men, no names to be used, want to tell you that what is happening north of their country in Iraq doesn't please them.
There is a movement inside the kingdom here for Iraq. Is that clear?
Yeah.
I mean that in the future, American will feel worse about this Iraq attack.
You have to learn to read between the lines in this country. The movement inside the kingdom, the speaker referred to, is the desire of young religious men to go support their Arab brothers in Iraq, whether the Iraqis want them there or not. The speaker is a university student studying at Imam Mohammed bin Saud Islamic University. Its massive campus is not far away. When you ask the question that every Western journalist who has visited the country since September 11th has asked, why did so many of the hijackers come from Saudi Arabia? His response is almost a paraphrase of, what did you expect?
You know, why Saudi Arabia always getting jihad from here? Because the Islam coming from here, from Mecca or Medina. We want to increase the number of Muslims on the world.
Throughout Saudi Arabia, the sense of being the guardians of Islam because Mecca and Medina are here is palpable. King Fahd's official title is Keeper of the Two Holy Mosques. And because Islam has been thrust violently into the foreground of world affairs, its future and Saudi Arabia's future are linked. It makes life in the kingdom of the House of Saud more tense than it has ever been. Three key events brought Saudi Arabia to this moment.
Iraq's battle-trained army, the most powerful force in the Middle East, swept across Kuwait's borders at first light.
Following those meetings, the Saudi government requested our help, and I responded to that request by ordering U.S. air and ground forces to deploy to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
One of its closest allies.
Let me be clear.
Some have questioned the loyalty of Saudi Arabia after investigators learned that most of the September 11 hijackers came from that country. Now, the FBI is asking whether two of the
hijackers...
A congressional
report released in July implied that the Saudi government was linked to these September 11th hijackings, angering both Saudis and Americans.
Tonight, in Saudi Arabia, explosions. There was a car bombing in a suburb of Riyadh at a compound...
Secretary of State Colin Powell says at least 10 Americans were killed in a series of suicide bombings in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. He said many non-Americans were also killed. Powell made the comments as he arrived in Riyadh.
The attack, in which 10 Americans were killed, took place in May 2003 and turned out to be just the opening salvo in a campaign of violence waged by Islamic terrorists in the kingdom. The target of the May attack was the Alhambra compound, home to many employees of Vanel, a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman. Through the Pentagon, Vanel has the contract to train the Saudi National Guard, an elite unit that protects the royal family. So important is this unit that the de facto manager of Saudi Arabia's affairs, Crown Prince Abdullah, is called commander of the National Guard. Al-Qaeda is suspected of carrying out the bombings. Yet, after the first attack, there were reports that members of the National Guard had provided arms to Al-Qaeda over the years. The May bombing provoked two responses in Saudi Arabia, surprise and an immediate government crackdown on suspected militants. Police raided farmhouses not far from the Dana Coffee House and found large caches of weapons. Mazen Motabagani teaches at Imam Mohammed bin Saud Islamic University. His special area of research is how the Islamic world is perceived in the West. I asked him if he was surprised by the attacks.
Surprised and not surprised. Our society, or in Saudi Arabia, is not an open society where things were not discussed in the open. We could have prevented this if we had a more open society.
You can understand Mazen Motabagani longing for a more open society. He was educated in the U.S. 35 years ago. But an open society was always going to be difficult to achieve here. Since uniting most of the Arabian Peninsula by the sword in the first third of the 20th century, the House of Saud has ruled the nation as an absolute feudal monarchy. There are no elected bodies in the country, so there are no political parties. Political legitimacy is conveyed to the royal family by its close relationship with the leaders of the Wahhabi sect of Islam. It's a relationship that goes back hundreds of years. That much is clear. But like so many other aspects of Saudi society, the details of the modern relationship between the House of Saud and the clergy are completely opaque. It isn't even clear who runs religion in the country.
Nobody's in charge here. There are no clergymen in the Islamic religion, and Saudi Arabia follows a strict interpretation of Islam. So we will not have a pope, we will not have an ayatollah or anything of that matter.
Mohammed Al-Qureji of the Arab News newspaper.
Who's in charge is a collective thing, based on the Islamic scholars, which include the Grand Mufti and his associates.
And how deep does their influence go?
Now, if they had recommended something which would have an adverse effect on the kingdom, it will be rejected. They don't have that veto power that a lot of people imply.
The religious community may not have the power over state policy, but it has tremendous power at street level. The enforcers of the Council for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, the Mutawa Police, roam the country, aggressively enforcing Islamic rules on behavior. The religious leadership also controls the country's education system, to the chagrin of Mazen Motabagani.
The problem with the religious community is we have, I sometimes call them the small dictators. It's not easy sometimes to live within these universities or these schools teaching religion and to be open-minded, to be innovative. There are so many ways to curtail or to stop your activities.
Motobagani's critique of education has a historical context.
In the last 200 years or more in the Islamic world, religious studies were taken by the less talented students. The more gifted are those who will study physics, chemistry, engineering, medicine. Those who are applying for medical schools should have 95% average, while those who go to Islamic schools don't need more than 75 or 70 or even 50. So you're stuck with a huge number of students who are going to study religion. And religion is not a matter that can be taken easily. I think we should have taken religion more seriously.
It's hard to imagine a society where religion is taken more seriously, except maybe Afghanistan under the Taliban. But Afghanistan doesn't have oil money with which to buy modernity. Nor does Afghanistan have the money to import its workforce. The population of Saudi Arabia is 24 million. 5.5 million of those people are foreign workers. They do virtually everything, from sweeping the streets to managing the shops to staffing the hospitals. And at night, they congregate in Riyadh's Batha district market.
Saudi? Indian?
Even young Saudis come here to haggle in a patois of Arabic and English over purchases of life's necessities. In this case, the bloomer-style underpants the men wear under their ankle-length white shirts called thobes.
Are they Indian also?
The market in Bata sprawls up and down alleyways either side of a highway overpass. It's as close as Riyadh comes to having a traditional bazaar. But even here, there are sounds missing. A hint of music hits a listener like the pleasurable shock of air conditioning when you come out of the 105-degree heat.
No, keep it going. It's beautiful. Tell me to keep going.
It's a strange music store that doesn't play music to entice customers. But this is the kind of place the religious police, the Mutawa, would visit to make sure that the haram activity of playing music wasn't happening. The Pakistani shopkeeper, a devout Muslim, has his doubts about this excessive Islam.
No enjoy. Enjoy, no. So there.
No enjoy, boring.
Only work. Only sleeping.
Work and sleeping, work, Saudi.
Bas. Only work and sleeping.
That's all there is.
Just thinking. Only no enjoy.
Bata is a forlorn place at night, a place where you can feel time slowly being butchered. Its streets are lined with men shuffling along at loose ends, separated from their families for months and even years at a time. They work in Saudi Arabia to earn salaries that are tiny by American standards, but huge by the standards of the villages they come from in Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Malaysia, or the Philippines. But they never fully integrate into Saudi society, and the locals ignore them. The nice thing about Bata for a visitor to Riyadh is that it's the one place where men and women can speak to one another, if there are no Mutawa around, and talk about their lives.
I'm a nurse.
You're a nurse?
Yeah. We're working in National Guard Hospital.
In the National Guard Hospital? So you're all nurses?
Yes.
Ah, yes. So it's United.
Yeah.
Ah, I see.
We're working. We work with American people,
yeah,
with the British people. Yeah.
All right.
So it's fine. Our hospital is fine. We don't have complaint about, yes, salary, about the treatment. It's good. We're safe.
Yeah.
We're safe here. Yeah.
I think the obvious question that I'm supposed to ask is, is it difficult, you know, as women,
yeah,
professional women,
yeah,
in a country where, you know, I go into the street and I don't see any women? Is that a big change? Well, you're new here, so is it a big change for you?
In part of Saudi Arabia.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. To see photos of Michael Goldfarb's trip and to read his journal about the difficulties of being a foreign correspondent in Saudi Arabia, visit WBUR.org or WRNI.org. In the forecast, partly cloudy tonight, a low around 40. For tomorrow, partly cloudy with highs in the 50s, mostly sunny on Sunday, highs in the mid-50s. Right now it's 48 in Boston, 44 in Providence. It's 8:22.
WBUR supporters include Robbins, Kaplan, Miller & Cerisi, LLP, a national law firm serving clients in Boston for over 20 years in technology, finance, intellectual property, and insurance. RKMC.com. And by Warner Home Video and JFK Two-Disc Special Edition, a film by Oliver Stone including Beyond JFK, The Question of Conspiracy, now available.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Shifting Sounds, Saudi Arabia, Inside Out. Like the U.S., Saudi Arabia is bordered on the east and west by ocean. And, like the U.S., you're more likely to encounter liberal society on the coasts rather than in the middle of the country. Of course, liberal in Saudi Arabia is a very relative term. The town of Hafuf in eastern province is just inland from the Persian Gulf. At a bathhouse on its outskirts, in a massive plantation of date palms, the men of the Al Amir clan, the many, many men of the Al Amir clan, are getting ready for a wedding. Two of their number are getting married this evening, and dozens of them have come to this indoor facility to fool around and give the grooms a good scrubbing so they're clean for their brides. Are Shia. Shia make up around 8% of the population of Saudi Arabia, and almost all of them originate in Eastern Province. Their minority status is based on sect, not ethnicity. Their Islamic practice is distinctly more lively than that of the Wahhabis, the Sunni sect who dominate Saudi's official religious circles. The look over your shoulder, you don't know who's listening, police-state tension that characterizes conversations in Riyadh is absent here. You're among people who know they're second-class citizens and don't have as much to lose as the majority Sunni if they speak their minds. People feel free to laugh and to joke.
They speak. They don't worry.
So what is
it? America occupied East Province.
Yeah. As open as everything seems, some rules can't be broken, like a strange man being in the same room as one of the extended family's women.
Oh, sorry.
This is some lady here.
It's not worth arguing about.
The wedding itself did not offer an opportunity for similar social gaffes. Everyone starts gathering at the wedding hall around 10 p.m. Men and boys occupy one enormous set of rooms, the women another. They never meet up. There's even a wall outside separating the two entrances. The men sit in groups of five or six, and platters with lamb and fish and rice, lots of rice, are brought out. Meanwhile, a group of singers spin out songs of Ali and Hussein, the saints of the Shia. When dinner is over, a queue forms, and the men come over and kiss the grooms on the cheek three times. Then everyone settles back down for the one pastime that is not haram, not forbidden, talking. I stepped outside for a breath of air and found myself speaking with a local businessman who wondered what on earth the American government thought it was dealing with all these years in Saudi Arabia.
The United States government does not know that we are Wahhabi since day one. Why now the Wahhabi is the source of terror and Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they are developing more terrorist people. This is the same Saudi. It has not been changed. It's the same one. But the one who has changed is the American government.
Like so many people in Saudi Arabia, he longs for reform, but doesn't want reforms to be instigated by U.S. pressure.
People, in order to achieve their rights, they need really to start a civilian movement within the society. Otherwise, any achievement done by outsider, applying some kind of force on the government, will not be the true one.
For the Shia, the grievances are real. Their lives are thoroughly circumscribed by the ancient prejudice the majority Sunni express towards them. There are no Shia in the senior levels of the military, no Shia in the diplomatic service. None of the local school principals are from their community. Their children find themselves discriminated against in getting university places. Not that any of this is codified in law. It's just the way things are. The day after the wedding, I was invited to meet with local business leaders and clerics. They were talking about the difficulties of fighting for rights in a society where no rights are guaranteed, and certainly not in writing.
This is a problem. What?
This is the problem. Yeah, this is the problem, actually. Which you mentioned it, there is no system, no constitution. Usually they said our Holy Quran is our constitution. Okay, but there is no constitution, there is no system, political system. Any minority in this country ask for their right through where you apply. You cannot apply. There is nothing clear. It's written 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, 5, 6, something like that.
And because nothing is written, people who speak out about political rights have no idea when they will say something that will get them arrested.
Okay, maybe you have done something which is dealing with a political activity, like you distribute a political statement or something like that about a group. When they arrested you, you didn't know. They put you in the prison, and when they punish you, you didn't know. You stay in the prison for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, you don't know. Everything is unclear, actually, in this country. Everything unclear.
Beyond guarantees of rights, the Shia are angry because the thing that makes Saudi Arabia, is just underneath their feet. Oil. An hour up the road from Hafuf is Dahran, home of Saudi Aramco. The Aramco campus is an American suburb plonked down in the middle of the desert, with all the facilities of an American gated community, including a golf course with sand traps that go on forever. There's also a fabulous museum of oil, full of interactive exhibits.
Many of the world's great scientific ideas started right here. You can explore the history of Arabian and Islamic technical innovation in the Heritage Gallery. Press a gallery on the map in front of you.
If Islam is the unshakable foundation of the House of Saud, oil revenue provides the walls and roof of their palace. 70 years ago, Aramco's antecedent, Standard Oil of California, cut a deal to explore 350,000 square miles of Arabia for oil. The result for the House of Saud was a marriage made in heaven.
Oil GDP is by far the largest part of Saudi Arabia's productive activity. I think it's about 90 or 95% of GDP.
Valerie Marcel, senior researcher at London's Royal Institute of International Affairs. One of her research subjects is what happens to the oil revenue generated by Saudi Aramco.
They get oil revenues from the sale of the crude oil and the sale of the refined products. This money is transferred to the government, and then it goes into a black box. And no one knows what's in the black box, how the money is transferred from the black box to other people.
According to Marcel, Saudi Arabia provides only the most limited information to international bodies.
As it stands, it's very sketchy profile we get of the national accounts for Saudi Arabia. The problem is, what does religious or cultural spending mean? There, the UN has to fit Saudi Arabia in a category that doesn't really exist because they don't know what social expenditure is. And, of course, the question since September 11th is, does this include funding for Sharia schools abroad? Does it mean some kind of more militant religious expansionism?
Saudi oil revenues are projected to reach $85 billion this year. Most of that revenue will not go to militant religion. It will be distributed among the 20,000-plus members of the royal family and find its way into society via public sector jobs. 80% of the country's jobs are in the public sector.
Hiring such a large quantity of people to do very little, I imagine, is a way of spreading the oil wealth. They give subsidies, they give jobs, education and healthcare in exchange for young Saudis' support of the political system. They're not demanding democracy. They're not demanding more than what they get, as long as they have the job and the subsidies, the free telephone, and etc. It's part of the deal.
But for how much longer? The oil won't last forever. And Saudi Arabia's population has exploded in the last two decades. More than half the people in Saudi Arabia are under 18 years of age. Sooner or later, make-work jobs in the public sector will shrink, and the Saudi economy will have to create real jobs for Saudi men to do. Already, the unemployment rate is closing in on 20%. Unemployment figures like that have set off warning lights from Washington to Riyadh. Valerie Marcel points out one reason why there isn't mass unrest already in the kingdom.
In Saudi Arabia, young men are really protected by a family network. You're always the cousin of someone, the nephew, or you still have a social status even without a job. And I think that's important to explain why there's an uprising of young men.
The food court at the Al Rashid shopping mall in Al Khobar, just down the road from Aramco headquarters, gets crowded at lunchtime with students from King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals. They chow down on fast food from the U.S., Iran, India, and, of course, China. Like college students everywhere, they have a bluff confidence in their knowledge of what's wrong with the world and how they intend to fix it. At one table, a group of four guys, all Sunnis, were happy to explain to me why getting unemployed Saudis back to work would be difficult.
Saudi people want high salary and not very effective or efficient in the work. For this reason, I think. He doesn't work full time, maybe. He come late and want to finish early, something like that.
But you guys are not going to be like that, obviously.
Yeah, we are next generation. We have another attitude.
These young men want more Saudis in senior positions. The government couldn't agree more and has been calling for a program of Saudiization, putting Saudis in jobs that are currently performed by foreigners. The government isn't talking about just senior white-collar jobs, however. They're talking about training Saudis to be barbers and tailors and shopkeepers. The young men demonstrate the unified field theory of Saudi public opinion. When speaking to a foreigner, they agree on everything. They dislike the way they are portrayed in the Western press, resent the impression of Islam given there, and don't like the Saudi government's decision, taken at the behest of the Bush administration, to remove the collection boxes from the mosques. Money collected at the mosques is believed to fund Islamic terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Hamas.
We give the mosque charity, and it will go to the good people.
You don't think it
who need it?
You don't think it goes to Al Qaeda or
no? Maybe Hamas. It will go to Hamas, but Al Qaeda.
No. And you have no problem with it going to Hamas?
No, Hamas. No.
Why?
No problem. Because do its job to prevent a Palestinian life.
Okay, so you guys all think the same. What do you disagree about?
Yeah, nothing. Nothing.
A few tables away, some Shia students are not quite as bullish on their post-university prospects.
Nobody's confident. Maybe a small percentage of the students is confident.
Yeah.
I know, maybe because oil is the only large industry in Saudi Arabia, so if you can't find the job in oil companies, there's a slim chance you're going to find a job anyway.
At least if you're a Shia, denied access to government jobs. Their prescription for improving the employment situation in their country would be to change the education system.
Too many Islamic subjects. Islamic
stuff,
Arabic history, geography in school. Even if you're taking science courses, you want to go into engineering, you have to take lots of these. We have 5 different Islamic subjects in school each year, each semester.
Really?
Yeah, five. In schools.
So it's like religious indoctrination.
Yeah.
Are they trying to convert you? Exactly. They want to make you Sunni.
Maybe. Ask that guy.
And whatever that guy says, they all agree with. After a while in Saudi Arabia, you get used to the unanimity of opinion, and you get used to how circumspect people are in discussing the nation's problems. A slight tinge of fear lurks in all these discussions. Freedom of speech, when it comes to politics, is something Saudis aren't accustomed to practicing. This is a special report from WBUR Boston. Shifting Sands, Saudi Arabia, Inside Out. I'm Michael Goldfarb. When we come back, a visit to Jeddah, where more and more groups are being formed to do that unremarkable, remarkable thing. Speak out for reform.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. To see photos of Michael Goldfarb's trip and to read his journal about the difficulties of being a foreign correspondent in Saudi Arabia, visit WBUR.org or WRNI.org. In the forecast, partly cloudy tonight, a low around 40. Partly cloudy on Saturday with a high around 50. Mostly sunny on Sunday with highs in the mid-50s. Then rain possible by late in the day on Monday. Right now it's 47 in Boston, 44 in Providence. It's 8:38.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive solutions celebrating 20 years in business, cmndesign.com. And by florabotanica.com, a Boston online flower shop where you can choose from their original designs or create your own. Local and worldwide delivery is available, florabotanica.com.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Shifting Sands, Saudi Arabia, Inside Out. Saudi Arabia is a nation that adheres together rather than coheres. It's a patchwork of population centers separated by thousands of square miles of barely habitable desert. In this patchwork, the region with the longest history of engagement with the outside world is the Hejaz, home of the two holy cities, Mecca and Medina, and the gateway to them, the Red Sea port of Jeddah. Jeddah, population 2 million, has long been a cosmopolitan and, in Saudi terms, liberal place. For 1,400 years, this has been the arrival port for Muslim pilgrims traveling to Mecca, around 60 miles inland. New ideas constantly flow through the city. Not surprisingly, the pressure for government reform in the kingdom, modest as it is, comes from here. This is the sound of the reform movement at work in Saudi Arabia. In a big white room with white marble, and he accepted the letter. If you don't live in an absolute monarchy, it's hard to understand how important the crown prince's gesture was. Abdullah Bakheder was loath to give details about what was contained in the petition. He felt that it would betray the confidence of a conversation with the crown prince. He emphasized the fact that the crown prince had read it, and that gave the petition real legitimacy.
The government itself now opened a dialogue between the different institutions, between the individual and the groups, and this is what is taking place now. It's a part of the dialogue. It's a part of
but what comes out of this dialogue?
A lot of it's coming out of it. I mean, it's maybe a little bit slow, but it's really, there is a sincere wish.
Not all the regulars at Mohammed Sayed Tayyib's Majlis think that talking about reform is enough.
You can talk until you're blue in the face.
Khalid Al-Mayna, editor of Arab News newspaper.
Unless words are translated into action, this will raise the aspirations and the hopes of the people, and then suddenly you discover that this is all talk, and this could really be counterproductive.
Khalid Al-Mayna has a very clear idea of what the ruling family could do to prove it is serious about changing Saudi society.
We would like to see empowerment of people where the regional issues will be solved within a regional context. So if I have in my area certain problems, I don't need to wait for a total government plan. I would rather than start focusing on the issues that are of prime concern to me.
The request for a bit of local democracy was the essence of the petition presented by Mohammed Zayed Taib's group to Crown Prince Abdullah during the summer. And recently, the Saudi government announced that local elections will take place sometime in 2004. Those elections will be the first ever held in the royal kingdom. But a little local democracy is just one item on editor Khalid Al-Mina's checklist of what he wants changed in his country.
There should be a drastic change in the educational system, not because Rumsfeld or Powell or Ashcroft wanted, but because we need it so that we can be travelers in the road of life and progress, be competitive and not just be bystanders.
Some education reforms have been announced. Saudi authorities have removed a chapter from a secondary school Islamic text, the Tawhid. The chapter is called Loyalty and Disavowal, which instructs students how to deal with non-Muslims. But changing textbooks is only scratching the surface. For more than two decades, a certain kind of teacher has predominated in Islamic schools and universities, according to educator Mazen Motabagani.
Some of the minds of those in Islamic studies think that their own understanding of Islam is the only correct, truthful understanding of Islam. And when such views are transmitted to the students, it becomes really dangerous. So we have a portion of students of Islamic studies who are troublesome, not to the outside world, you know, to their own society, sometimes to their own families. A person who with such views boycott even his parents.
Editor Khalid Al-Mayna says it's the religious that's changing, and that, in his view, is not a job for the House of Saud.
It's people like us, it's people in the media. We have to come out and really tell them enough is enough. You cannot hijack the society. You cannot preach only one view of Islam. You cannot sort of have one interpretation of Islam. I mean, there has to be tolerance. There has to be a dialogue, communication between all our people.
But how? With whom do you have this dialogue? Where will this dialogue take place? In Saudi Arabia, Islam is everywhere in everything. From before the sun rises, it's the sound that wakes people. It is the censor of thoughts. It is the political doctrine of private man and public man, as well as his spiritual guide. In Saudi Arabia, Islam is a concept of religion beyond the power of our language to explain. Here's an example of what I mean. At the end of my trip to Saudi Arabia, I flew to Abha in the mountains near the Yemeni border. Abha is a decent-sized regional city and silent as the grave, except when its many muezzins are calling. The sound rolls up the brown, stubble-covered hillsides. The government has spent millions of dollars in Abha, turning it into a resort town. An amusement park near a reservoir has been built. Cable cars glide from hilltop to hilltop, where luxury hotels receive visitors. Profit doesn't seem to be a big motive in building the resort. It's only open 3 months a year. It seems to have been built by the government to make a statement about its modernizing intentions. You probably have in your mind an accurate vision of what the place looks like, and make an assumption from that that you share many modern points of view with the people who live there. But Saudi Arabia is a society that suffers from a multiple cultural personality disorder, and an outsider's assumptions about its people, based on what you see on the surface, are apt to be wrong. Out of season, the big event in Abha is Friday afternoon prayers.
Sadiqa
Recently, the sermons have been anodyne as the Saudi regime tries to rein back in the political preaching which has encouraged a generation to fight Islam's enemies, real and imagined, around the world. It's a little late for that. Several of the September 11th hijackers came from the Abha region. They did not come out of nowhere. The intellectual distance they traveled to Osama bin Laden wasn't that far. Radical Islam is ordinary Islam here. And in the name of Islam, very little that Westerners hold dear is sacred. The right of the public citizen to speak his mind, for example. The Abha office of Al-Watan, Saudi Arabia's main newspaper, is guarded by an armored vehicle with a machine gun mounted on it. The paper has been threatened by local Islamists. Its last editor was forced to leave the country because of death threats. Saudi Arabia is the place where the triumphal discourse of globalism runs aground. Globalization supposes that somehow, because a society uses modern technology and products, its citizens have a modern mindset. But this country is the place where ultra-modernity collides with feudalism. And if you want to figure out how the conflict between the modern and the feudal may resolve itself, you need to go to London, where a Saudi can speak freely, and speak with Saad al-Faghi, head of the Movement for Islamic Reform in Arabia.
The religious establishment is huge. The regime succeeded in converting religion into commerce, into job, very much dependent on the regime.
Saad al-Faghi explains, the Supreme Religious Board of Directors is paid for by the Saudi regime. The entire justice system, with clergymen sitting in judgment, is paid by the regime. The police of the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, the Mutawa, paid for by the regime, as well as the three religious universities and the schools associated with them.
So, if you put all those together, you are talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs which are dependent on the regime. And unless you agree with what the regime wants, you're going to be sacked from your job. So you have an army of religious establishment, whether it is minor rule like a student in a university or a very major rule like member of this board, or the maximum rule like the mufti, this army creates this culture that if you are an opponent to the regime, you are heretic.
In Faghi's view, this is an army of oppression analogous to the secular apparatus of control found in Saddam's Iraq and Bashar al-Assad's Syria. But because it is based in religion, it adds the extra level of fear inherent in that concept beyond the secular mind, heresy. Heretics burn in hell. Saad al-Faghi, who considers himself a modern Islamist, trained as a surgeon in Britain and returned to London 9 years ago to begin a campaign for greater democracy in Saudi Arabia. Saad al-Faghi makes use of all the tools of modernity, broadcasting a daily radio program via satellite into the Royal Kingdom. He claims tens of thousands of people listen, and recently, at his call, people have been staging anti-government demonstrations, something unheard of in the history of Saudi Arabia.
What we achieved is to dislocate, to separate Islam from the regime's deeds, regime's actions, regime pretense. The moment we succeeded in that, we made people comfortable. They were brave enough to go on and face the regime.
Saad al-Faghi says that until his radio broadcasts started reaching Saudis, they had no way to channel their anger against the regime other than tacit or overt support of the anti-American strategy of violent Islam, as represented by al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden.
Violent Islam, especially in the fashion which has happened in the last few years, has got all to do with the conspiracy between the royal family and the government of the United States. The royal family goes on with its oppression and corruption and putting people in a very narrow corner, and the United States conspire with the royal family to loot the country's resources and worries only about its interests.
Sir Adolf Agee claims that many Saudis think the U.S. dominates the royal family. They resent what they see as American control of their nation because of the history of U.S. involvement in the oil industry.
People convinced that Bin Laden is a big thing because he forced America to respond to him. Bin Laden says, hold on, your problem is not with the royal family. Your problem is with the master of the royal family, who is protecting them and giving them orders to oppress you, to loot your resources. So you have to fight the master. If we paralyze the master, we can deal with the slave. And they are convinced, because you don't need to make a big story to convince people to fight America. You have, while if you want to fight Bin Saud, the royal family, you have to build very powerful arguments because of this culture that Bin Saud, the royal family, is the leader of Muslim country.
Sir Adolf Agee, however, says that violent Islam is not the way he would bring change to Saudi Arabia.
We have published our political program, and we believe that if we are fortunate, it would happen by civil action, that we mobilize the people in a peaceful way, and we convince the regime to leave, just like the Iranians succeeded in expelling the Shah.
Saad al-Faghi speaks of the fall of the House of Saud with the certainty of someone who has literally put his life on the line for a cause. Earlier this year, unknown assailants attacked him in his home. Editor Khalid Almeyna is equally certain the House of Saud will be around for a while. Over the last couple of decades, two massive upheavals have been regularly predicted: a big earthquake destroying Los Angeles and the fall of the House of Saud. I asked Khalid Almeyna which he thought was more likely.
The big one hitting L.A. Let me tell you something about the House of Saud. I'm not batting for them. I believe the Al Saud are necessary because they are the glue that holds this country together. What do I have in common with somebody in the south of Arabia? Nothing. It is the Al Saud that hold me to them. The royal family is the glue that holds all this mosaic together. And I shudder to think of this country without them.
Even Saad al-Faghi doesn't expect the end of the regime anytime soon.
Our optimism is not very high. We believe that the regime would resist this and would use violence. And we are worried that we might pass through a stage of chaos.
Until recently, chaos was not a word associated with the House of Saud. But despite the arrest of hundreds of Islamic militants in the last 6 months, terrorists are still capable of striking.
At least one and as many as three explosions shook the Saudi Arabian capital, Riyadh.
The streets of Riyadh, a stream of police and emergency vehicles respond to the attack. Residents in the west.
So far, the number we are receiving is up to 100 injured or killed. Mostly foreigners.
King Fahd gave a statement yesterday promising to bring the people responsible to justice, talking about showing a fist of iron to terrorism. But what was remarkable about it was the fact that he appeared at all.
Since the 1930s, the House of Saud has ruled without question as feudal overseer of its nation's oil wealth and its religion. But today, there's a battle going on for the soul of Islam. And now, members of the royal family can feel the sands of Arabia shifting beneath their feet. The question is, can a little reform keep them in charge? Or will a more militant Islamic voice, Saad al-Faghi's, or someone else's, drive them from power?